Hi, Blogging Heads viewers. This is Daniel Strauss of Woodruff & Strauss, and I am here today with my colleague and eponymously named counterpart, or I guess that's not how the proper use of that word.
My parents named me after this. Yeah. My parents named me after this Blogging Heads show. It was really cool.
Also, sorry, there were some commenters who were complaining a few episodes ago that I was eating. Sorry, I haven't had a chance to, like, eat until now, today. Sorry, I chose a food that's not disruptive to the mic. Anyway, we are here today. Betsy, I've been in Politico HQ for most of the big happenings on the Hill, but Betsy has been on the Hill for the big news of the week, which is Kevin McCarthy. deciding not to run for speaker.
Yeah.
And now apparently John Boehner is begging Paul Ryan to do it. Betsy, like, what happened exactly?
Well, the trouble with reporting on this is separating sort of rumor and conspiracy theory from fact. Because as soon as McCarthy announced that he was not going to run, the Hill kind of exploded with all sorts of conspiracy theories about why he made that choice. Capitol Hill, offices, Twitter, pundits, all sorts of theories floating around about why exactly he dropped out when he did. And you had lots of people sort of doing, reading between the lines of quotes that his allies had made in the past and trying to parse things. The official explanation is that McCarthy dropped out because he'd be too divisive to the caucus and they needed a uniter, not a divider, and he didn't think he'd be able to do it. The reality is that he probably would have had a bit of trouble, theoretically, maybe, getting to 218 votes. Of course, to be Speaker, you have to win the majority of the representatives, so that's 218. The Freedom Caucus, which has about 40 members, I think, which is like sort of basically the Tea Party caucus, had announced that they were backing Daniel Webster, Republican from Florida, which, theoretically would knock McCarthy down to below 40 votes, and you have a big problem. Of course, there are lots of rumors about McCarthy's personal life that I have not corroborated, that no reporter has corroborated, that thus far are not based on any evidence that we have.
So we will not name them, but I've heard some of those.
We will not name them. I don't want to be part of spreading a rumor that is, as far as I know, I have journalistic reason to take seriously.
Right.
But those are rumors that exist, and sort of the tipping point where what brought those rumors to a fever pitch is that Walter Jones, who is a kind of eccentric Republican congressman from North Carolina, eccentric in that interesting, unorthodox. He voted for the Iraq War and then came to deeply regret his vote and has written hundreds, if not thousands, of apology letters to families of Americans who died in Iraq. So an interesting person in his own right. Anyway, wrote a letter to the conference saying, if anyone is running for leadership and they have a moral turpitude in their past that could potentially make it harder for them to stay in power or lead to more disruption in the caucus, then they should not be running. And Tim Mack asked him if he was talking about anyone in particular. Walter Jones said, oh, of course not. Definitely no particular person. Definitely not naming any names. Just a general point.
Walter Jones has never been known as particularly subtle, right?
Everyone assumes he was pointing at McCarthy with that.
Right.
On top of that, a mysterious Republican donor, hang on, let's try to pull this guy's name, sends out an email that Ryan Grimm at Huffington Post has sort of theorized, what's the name of this donor? Let me pull it up. Steve Baer, who's from Chicago, sent out an email to a bunch of top Republicans, tons of them, basically saying McCarthy has this moral problem in his past and he should probably not be running for speaker because this is going to be a big problem for him. That's Steve Baer, a kind of mysterious Republican donor based in Chicago. So regardless of whether or not these rumors are based in fact at all, and I cannot comment on whether or not they're based in fact. I don't know. The reality is that they've gotten around, they've impacted McCarthy's reputation, they've gotten to a powerful Republican donor. A powerful Republican donor has cited these rumors in encouraging McCarthy and to step out of the race and encouraging other Republicans to push McCarthy to step out of the race. So that behind the scenes, I think, is very interesting. You know, my guess is that sort of the backroom calculations are obviously much more complicated than we realize. At this point, nothing will surprise me. it's one of those things where we're like, who the heck knows? And you're hearing all sorts of rumors and theories floating around last night. And it's crazy enough and chaotic enough that that you can't rule anything out. And it was really funny. So yesterday in the morning, I mean, literally no one had any idea about that McCarthy was stepping down. Members who spoke with him in a meeting at about 10 a.m., which was a few hours before the noon meeting where he announced he was bowing out, members who saw him at the 10 a.m. meeting said he was still just campaigning as usual, you know, sounded like a normal speaker candidate. And I almost didn't even go to cover the vote. I was talking about it, and Tim Mack, my coworker, was like, oh, I could probably use backup. Yeah, it'd be good. It'd be good to have another person there. And I'm like, okay, that's fine. I guess I'll write that thing I was thinking about writing about Jeb Bush and poverty. Okay, I'll be there. And I, you know, went down to the basement of the House office building and ate a sandwich, kind of relaxing, eating my Sun Chips, ambled up. There's this massive crowd of reporters swarming around this aide. It's kind of like,
what's going on? As a reporter, I found when all the other reporters are running in a direction, you run with them as fast
yep,
as you can.
Yep, you run that direction. Yep. it was such a scene. Like, Mark Sanford, a Republican from South Carolina, just wandered out of the
Appalachian Trail congressman.
Appalachian Trail guy. Wandered out of the meeting room looking shell-shocked, carrying this plate that was just piled high with barbecue and biscuits and coleslaw. And I asked him about it, and he was like, oh, yeah, this is what they were serving for lunch. The meeting finished so fast, I didn't have time to finish my lunch.
Okay, well, I want to ask you, though. The one thing that I've seen that I think the Washington Post reported, Robert Costa, is that there were some Congress people, like, visibly crying. Did you see that
as well. I did not see any members.
That seems dramatic.
Tim Huelskamp said that also to reporters as soon as he stepped out. He said that there were members who were crying, tearing up. A couple other members said there were people tearing up, crying. So I don't think this is people like sobbing. Mm-hmm. This isn't like college freshmen getting dumped by their significant other for the first time crying. But cheers. Mick Mulvaney said, for Justin Amash, I think he used the term visibly grieved. So it was a very shocking emotional hit to a lot of Republicans. You kind of punched in the gut.
So there are a lot of things, there are a lot of ways we could like explore here. I wrote yesterday how outside Republicans are patting themselves on the back and giddy about this because the view was that McCarthy and Matt Fuller in a previous episode explained that McCarthy's a little more liberal than Boehner. So this is a big scalp for them. But I guess I'm more interested in, like, I don't know, Betsy, do you think, like, how is Paul Ryan suddenly the great hope of all of this? Like, I mean, it doesn't...
yeah.
And you're more policy-minded on this stuff than I am. How do you... Is Ryan really sufficiently conservative enough and trustworthy enough to these outside Republicans who love to just bomb everyone? I mean, I asked
a thought on McCarthy and the Tea Party issue is that this just exemplifies why so many House conservatives and so many Tea Party activists are really frustrated, is because they have an enormous amount of power when it comes to stopping things from happening, right? They stopped the government from being funded for 2 weeks. They stopped immigration reform from going through. They've stopped all sorts of policy proposals that otherwise would have happened. And that power is significant and real and very impressive. They basically stopped Boehner from being speaker. They got McCarthy out. That's that is impressive, right? That's impressive accomplishments. But they do not have the ability to actually make new things happen. So they cannot affirmatively repeal the Affordable Care Act, right? They cannot single-handedly get rid of the Deferred Action for Child Arrivals executive amnesty program that Obama rolled out last year. There's all sorts of things that they, by themselves, do not affirmatively have the ability to push forward. They probably don't have the ability to get Daniel Webster elected speaker. Maybe. Probably not. And I think that odd bifurcation of enormous power sort of combined with total powerlessness is just weird. And it is weird, right? And I think it's something that members are having trouble figuring out how to manage. So, you know, it's kind of like in this case with them, with McCarthy bowing out because, you know, in part, at least according to the official explanation, because so many members refused to sort of stomp their feet and said they weren't going to vote for him. It's kind of like the dog that finally caught the mail truck. Do you know that analogy? Or
I get it.
Give it, right? It's like, oh, what are you going to do with this now? Congratulations, you got it. Great job. And you're like, even the mood yesterday, talking to some members from the Freedom Caucus, I thought was really telling. Louis Gohmert, who's one of the most outspoken, unfiltered critics of leadership, seemed just kind of sad and said, I'm not saying anything bad about Kevin McCarthy. That's one of the bravest things that I've ever seen somebody do. This is incredibly selfless of him. This is really, really amazing. Just visibly moved by McCarthy bowing out. Justin Amash said, nobody's excited or happy. Yeah. Nobody. Isn't that crazy? Can you imagine, like, if Obama had lost the election, everyone would have been excited and happy, right? These are people who took down the guy they wanted to take down, and everyone's kind of like, oh, what are we doing?
Yeah, what do we do now?
Yeah. So when it comes to Paul Ryan and how he fits into this, I think two things. First, obviously, nationally, he's a very popular figure just because he ran for vice president. I think there's an enormous well of support and goodwill to him that obviously still exists after that.
Right.
Very popular, very well-liked, very admired.
Right.
That said, I think if he were to become speaker, that would last for about 2 weeks. Because
it's kind of like Joe Biden. It's the same way, right? Like,
yeah,
when a prospective candidate floats the idea of running, usually their popularity is higher than actually when they run. And I guarantee you that is what's going to happen with Joe Biden if he runs. All of this, like, Joe could be great thing, it's going to go down. And the track record is that he ran twice before and didn't do well either time.
Well, so, and same your polls are best the day before you enter the race.
Right. So yeah. Same thing here, right?
Yeah. And what's funny to me is I think, and I'm sure hopefully people will correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it was Tea Party Patriots who was on the Hill yesterday passing out T-shirts that said anyone but McCarthy. And it's like,
really?
Congratulations, you got what you want. You're going to get anyone but McCarthy. They're probably not going to be happy about it. Because, I mean, look, Paul Ryan is on two of the issues that sort of separate the wheat from the chaff, for lack of a better analogy, separate the sort of Donald Trump populist Jeff Sessions wing of the party from the Chamber of Commerce wing of the party. Those two issues are trade and immigration, right? Immigration is a huge thing, and trade not as huge, but the people who are protectionist about immigration are also protectionist about trade. And Paul Ryan is supportive of some sort of comprehensive immigration overhaul, as far as I can tell. Definitely not a fire breather on immigration, and also a big fan of these free trade agreements that the president's pushed, and a fan of expanding the president's power to negotiate new free trade agreements. So to those two issues, which would obviously be a huge deal,
right,
people are going to be pissed. I think Paul Ryan probably gets that it's not, things are not necessarily going to be easy for him just because he isn't named John Boehner.
So, I mean, but is it possible that, I mean, you were right. And I think, and I want to caveat this question with the fact that this is not the du jour, the issue du jour, like immigration, but like Ryan is very conservative on entitlement reform, which is a favorite policy topic of mine. Would that satiate angry conservatives?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't think that people are going to say he's conservative on this one thing, therefore we're going to give him a pass to not be conservative on another thing. You know, I don't think they view him as, if he has enough conservative points, right, he can take away points on this issue and win points on this issue and he'll be happy. I don't think so. One thing that a lot of these guys are complaining about beyond the policy issues were the procedural stuff. And that's not an area that I understand very well. So we'll have to get Matt Fuller back to talk about that more. Scintillating and riveting topic.
I wish we had like a masthead for this show and like contributing reporters, because I definitely put Matt, Jim Newell, and Berg on there.
No, they're so good.
We
need to have a Christmas party.
We should have a Christmas party.
Discussion for down the road.
Yeah, that's a little preview. It sounds like, frankly, that a lot of no matter what, there's going to be some confrontation between a conservative champion and a establishment champion in the
end. I mean, Daniel Webster barely even counts as a conservative champion. They like him, but I think his Heritage Action score is below 70.
Really?
Yeah. He's not, in terms of his voting record, he's not seen as this far right guy.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that Freedom Caucus people have kind of repeated, and that I believe Eric Erickson has repeated as well, is like, just because this group of people doesn't like Boehner and doesn't like McCarthy doesn't mean they have to put forward an alternative. Mm-hmm. They've said that, right? Mm-hmm. That they don't feel a responsibility to rally behind one of their own. And I think they understand accurately that, Justin Amash isn't going to be speaker, or Louis Gohmert and Ted Yoho are probably not going to be the next speakers. But I don't think this is going to come down to a really conservative Freedom Caucus Tea Party guy versus a cufflinks and swooshy hair Chamber of Commerce dude. I don't think it's going to come down to that. I think it's going to come down to probably a series of people who are going to be friendly to the larger, moderate business wing of the Republican caucus. And those people will sort of try one after another to see if they can get enough support from the Freedom Caucus and the Tea Party folks to hit that 218 number. I think that's
It feels like, and again, I want to caveat that I've done very little reporting on this, and we have a congressional team that...
I want to caveat that I have no idea what I'm talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Just kidding. I want to caveat, I really don't have much. It just feels like so many of these radical pressure movements today, Black Lives Matter, the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, and the conservative wing, that there's no end goal, there's no defined end goal of these guys, which I got to finish this book by Eric Foner, sort of about this and radical Republicans pushing Lincoln on this, because I think this is relevant here. But like, it feels like there's no bargaining chip, or we're not going to see a defined point that would satiate everyone and unify the party.
What I have heard in turn, when Daniel McCarthy was talking, Daniel McCarthy and Dave Bratt were talking to reporters yesterday, right after McCarthy announced he was bowing out, they both talked about procedural changes they wanted to see happen. They wanted to see like the way debate is handled, the way votes are handled, treated differently. And I am not an expert enough on procedure to be able to sort of summarize what that would look like for them. But my gut says they probably have some valid complaints there, or they have complaints that they can certainly make a compelling case for. That said, would that be enough that they, happily have a comprehensive immigration reform bill to get a vote if only it was done through their preferred procedural avenue? Probably not.
Right.
But, I don't know. So
I wanted to shift gears a second here also, and talk about some other big news that broke late last night. I don't really know much more to say on this at the moment.
All out of takes.
I'm all out of takes here. Last night, we got some fundraising numbers in, which were super fascinating.
Yeah.
Ted Cruz raised $12.2 million. Marco Rubio raised $6 million in the third quarter. This is one of those super insidery baseball things that we love at Politico. And Jeb Bush was in sort of the middle, 11.4. It's kind of crazy to me that Rubio didn't raise as much as Cruz here.
That Rubio raised less than half what Cruz raised.
Right, less than half, and both those guys raised less than the $20 million Ben Carson raised and the $26 $1 million that Senator Sanders super PAC-less raised.
Yeah, I agree. And I think what's really interesting about that is that I think Rubio is kind of dangerously close to Kasich territory, where everyone in the Acela corridor thinks he's just this amazing, great candidate,
exactly,
so competitive, and who totally makes sense. And then it doesn't translate into money, it doesn't translate into grassroots enthusiasm. And, you know, meanwhile, we all kind of ignore Ben Carson and treat him like, you know, this goofy, bumbling oddball, but he's actually raising a lot of money.
It's funny, you know, it's funny how Carson has sort of just floated throughout,
yeah,
a lot of politics since he jumped into the race, and even before that, and then raises these huge sums. It seems like that's kind of the thing that Rubio wants to do right now, even though he's seen as this favorite, and you're right, in the Acela corridor, or this big champion. I mean, do you think this is just a telling number? Do you think it was just a bad fundraising quarter? It wasn't super impressive for all these
better
guys.
Better than last quarter, right?
Yeah.
For Rubio? I think it just shows that, like, when pundits said Rubio won the CNN debate, they were kind of wrong. Another thing I think is interesting is that Ted Cruz outraged Jeb Bush. That's a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, Jeb was supposed to be this fundraising powerhouse where, like, the reason he needed to be the nominee was because he'd be able to raise enough money to beat Hillary. Ted Cruz is outraising him. I mean, that just makes it even harder for him to make the case that he's the go-to guy. Other things that are interesting about those numbers, Rand Paul only raised, like, $2 million. Ted Cruz raised more than 10 times as much as Rand Paul.
My reporting on Paul, though, I don't see an immediate withdrawal. I think
still not pretty.
Yeah, it's not pretty. The campaign even maintains that it's not pretty. But they are, and Paul's campaign sent out a fundraising email yesterday being like, we're waiting for a surge, we're setting up for a surge. They're desperately hoping any day now.
But it will be happening
I don't
soon.
Think the campaign, and the campaign says we're going to run a lean operation.
They're going to have to run a lean operation. You're no kidding, you're going to run a lean operation. Correct.
No choice there.
Everyone likes continental breakfast.
And I've been asking that campaign over and over again, like, how did you get there from being like a candidate expected to be the top tier guy, the final viable libertarian option, who's like struggling just to stay relevant? I don't know. I think these are markers, though. In the end, like, I maintained for a while that Ted Cruz has taken a lot of steps to support the argument that he will last for a while.
Yep. Without a doubt. There's not a credible argument to be made whatsoever about Cruz.
Right.
Losing anytime soon. That's a goofy, ridiculous argument.
And I think
Cruz is in really good shape.
Yeah. I don't know about Rubio. I think personally that this fundraising number may be the result of where Rubio is positioned as an alternative to the establishment candidate, Jeb Bush, also tainted by the fact that he's been trying to lay low for a lot of the campaign. You know, altogether, you can either be the super viable other option or the lay low candidate, but you can't raise a huge amount of money by not doing anything.
Right, exactly. See what happens.
Yeah. So that's pretty much all I got.
So those are my takes.
Those are your takes. Okay. I wanted to do one other topic today if possible. And, it's kind of a sensitive one.
Thanks for springing this on.
Yeah. Sorry. I've been going back and forth about this. A little while ago, a conservative pundit named Mary Catherine Hamm lost her husband in a horrific accident. His name is Jake Brewer. He was a technology advisor for the White House. And the Washington Post wrote an excellent, excellent profile of the family. Hamm was a conservative pundit on Fox News. Brewer, obviously an Obama administration staffer. They had this family is picturesque and wonderful and beautiful. And just, it's an insane story. In the story, though, the Post said that bipartisan friendships or connections in D.C. are particularly rare. Our viewers, like, when we talk about this stuff. So I wanted to ask you, I kind of think, personally, that that is a little off.
Yes, what I have thoughts on that.
Okay.
First off, we should link to the memorial fund where people can donate if they're interested in supporting the education fund for Jake and Mary Catherine's kids. We also link to the Washington Post profile, of course. Mm-hmm. Heartbreaking, tragic story. Just like,
by all accounts,
just punches you in the gut.
I didn't know Jake.
I didn't know him either. I've met Mary Catherine once or twice. I don't know her well, but just, nobody says anything but good things about them.
Running group,
crushing story.
Which I do every Thursday, Jake's sister is apparently in it, and she was apparently great. It's a big running group, so I don't think I've met her, but like,
yeah.
Anyway, we will link to both of them.
Anyway, as far as the question about bipartisan relationships, I remember when I first moved to D.C. from New York, I was a National Review at the time. I remember kind of like being feeling a little skittish about that, sort of feeling like liberal reporters were going to kind of look at me askance and that, that there was going to be a certain level of hostility that would make it hard for me to be friends with people who I didn't fit in the same general ideological camp as. And for like the first couple of months I moved here, I pretty much just hung out with conservatives. Those are the people that I knew in my social circle.
Right.
And then just, over the course of times, I reported more and got out more and spent more time on the Hill. Got to know a bunch of reporters who were lefties, like big, pretty far lefties. And they're all great. And I don't consider myself an ideological hardliner by any stretch of the imagination. And it's not something that is part of how I do my reporting. I used to write for National Review. It's obviously not a secret. But I think it's really valuable to that people prioritize, especially in DC, spending a lot of time with people who disagree with them. Just because it's interesting. you have better conversation. You have more fun if you're talking to people who don't agree with you on everything. And I see that a lot. I see that a lot in journalism. Mm-hmm. I feel like in media circles that there is, it's not weird or unusual at all for people from conservative publications and people from liberal publications to be friends with each other, to get drinks with each other, to go out with each other, to hang out, to live together, et cetera. Like, just not weird.
Right.
I feel like on the media side or in the media world of DC, there's not a ton of ideological siloing. I also feel like writers from conservative publications are having a much easier time transitioning to mainstream publications, in part because conservative publications have just gotten better. Because for a while, all conservative writers were just trying to be George Will. And then it seems like, as far as I can tell, as far as I've heard, maybe in the last 5 to 10 years, particularly under the Obama administration, there's been a much bigger focus among conservative outlets on reporting rather than just opining.
Right.
And as conservative outlets have push to hire better reporters and to cultivate young reportorial talent, those reporters go on to mainstream outlets, mm-hmm. Which is great because ideological cross-pollination is awesome. Reporters from publications that have sort of vague ideological allegiances often have better sources, better insight. As far as the whole bipartisan friendship question, I can't really speak to what that looks like in terms of aides or think tanks or staffers. I just don't know.
Right.
But on the media side, I see very little evidence.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I think
that's a problem.
When I've asked sources and just people who I know who are on the other side and do the aide thing, I get the sense that it's a little rarer and more difficult. Definitely, mm-hmm. on the media side, there's an incredible amount of cross-pollination with along the political spectrum. I think it gets a little dicier when we're talking about a friendship between an aide and a reporter. But for the most part, I think you're right. So maybe this bit in there, I thought that was very well said on that point. That has been sticking with me for the past few days since I read the profile, which was excellent, and the whole story was tragic, but for some reason, I guess that bothers me. One of my best friends and I don't always agree personally on our political analyses, but we are still great friends.
It's good stuff.
Anyway, you're in New York right now, right?
Yes, indeed.
All right. You're at the Daily Beast HQ in New York. I was just wondering about that.
Got it, ma'am.
All right. Well, Betsy, as always, it's been great. Let's talk again later.
Talk again soon. Goodbye, blogging heads, viewers.
Bye, viewers. Talk to you later.